Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Bren Smith, who is the executive director of Green Wave, which is an ocean, an organization that is working to mitigate climate change and build a blue-green economy in our oceans. And I'll have Bren tell us more about it when he comes on in just a little bit. But I also want to share with you some things going on in and around the city, some things that are in the news that are important to know about, and share an experience I had this past week that was really exciting. So let's start there. I just got back from L.A. where I participated in a an evening event called Wild Vessel. And I have to say I was introduced to Wild Vessel because my daughter is the founder of it. So I do want to plug that right there. But it was really an amazing event. It's bringing people together in this time of our world where people are really looking at gender issues and women's rights and women's inequality, or not inequality, but vision, the way we're treated is unequal. You know, her timing is just really great in bringing women together in this sisterhood evening, and yet there are men that are invited as well. And it's an event that that embraces the feminine in women and in men, and tries to highlight those qualities and bring people together around dance and movement and spoken word and massage and meditation, and it's just an all-inclusive evening that was just really beautiful. And I actually was brought out there to do the food, and I, you know, catered the event. About 250 people were there, and it was just a magical evening. I think everybody left really feeling enlivened and wonderful and close to each other, and had a new sense of womanhood. And it was just, it was really a special event. And they will be coming to New York, so I will let you know when that happens. So stay tuned. And then Tuesday evening, I went to the People's Climate Movement's organizational meeting in New York, which I did not want to miss because our environment is a crucial problem that we all need to deal with all the different issues that exist, whether it's health, environment, food. They all come back to our planet and our environment. And if we don't get climate change under control, you know, all these other issues will be a moot point. So it's really important that we focus on that. And so this brought together many different coalitions working together to raise awareness. And, of course, this is focused in New York. There are organizational meetings in cities all around the country. If you go to the People's Climate Movement, you can find work being done in your area. But we were talking about divesting New York, and there's some movement there, finally. You know, there are cities like Seattle and some others that have managed to divest from any investments in fossil fuel infrastructure and invest instead in alternative energies and things for the future. And so New York right now has not done that, but we are working and pushing and trying to get them to divest from fossil fuels. 350.org is an incredible organization behind that movement, so check them out. Then there was also a group focusing on Puerto Rico recovery, one on renewable energies and the fossil fuel infrastructure. And then there was also Food and Water Watch working for national legislation to really promote work up in Albany and down in Washington, D.C. to move environmental protections forward. And this week, you know, I wrote about the EPA and the cuts in the proposed budget to the Environmental Protection Agency, and they're really looking to roll back protections that protect our oceans, and as well as so many other things they're trying to roll back. So we really need to come together. This is such an important time for us to stand together in solidarity for our environment and for our planet. And we need to speak up and let our voices be heard. And so there are petitions up on my website to through the Friends of the Earth to ask our representatives to not support that cut and to give money to cleaning up the oceans. I just can't tell you how important it is, and we'll talk more about that when my guest comes on for sure. There's also a petition to reduce your exposure to toxic BPA. You know, that's the plastic lining in so many of the cans when you eat canned food. And so this is just, you know, really encouraging people to eat fresh food, frozen food. If you're going to eat anything out of a can, please make sure it's BPA lining free. You know, when you buy packaged foods, definitely do not microwave it in any type of plastic. Transfer it into glass first. Really, really important. And the Environmental Working Group has a great list that has a BPA product list so that you can look and see what products have BPA and how you can, you know, they actually have a whole score there so you can really protect yourself. What else did I want to? Hold on a minute. Oh, also lead in water. That's, you know, another really important issue, and I have a petition on my website about that because they're cutting protections for that. You know, they're saying that they're going to really look into lead in water, and yet when they looked at the testing that has recently been done, over 1,000 communities had levels that were too high in their drinking water. And that was also with the Environmental Working Group. They're a great organization if you don't know them. But they tested data and found that more than 1,000 communities nationwide had water that was tainted above the lead action level. So it's really a serious issue, and just add it to the list. I mean, there are so many serious issues, as we all know. But it's important for us to, you know, really, again, band together and let our voices be heard and become politically active, because that's the only way we're going to make any changes. Some things that are coming up around the city that I want to tell you about that you might want to see. Tomorrow night there's a great documentary film happening at the Rutgers Presbyterian Church in New York City, and it's called Taking Root, The Vision of Wangari Maathai. And she is a Kenyan-born activist who was the first one to get her doctorate in all of Africa, first woman. She was the founder of the Green Belt Movement and 2004 Nobel Peace Prize laureate. And this is a documentary film about her life and the work that she did. And it's supposed to be an amazing film. So check that out. It's free, and it's tomorrow evening at the Rutgers Presbyterian Church, starting at doors open at 6. There is the Food Tank Summit coming up in Washington, D.C. I know it is a sold-out event. However, you can live stream it, so I really recommend. Food Tank is a wonderful think tank focusing on our food systems globally and what we can do to make our food more sustainable. So they have, you know, I've gone every year. This year I'm not able to make it, but I've gone for the last 4 years, and it's always a wonderful, informative day. So check that out. You can stream it, like I said, for free, so it's really worth it. March 1st, up at Stone Barns at Blue Hill is having a beer tasting. So if you want to check out a very high-end beer tasting with delicious bites to go along with it, that's Thursday, March 1st. Also, coming up is the 6th Annual Massachusetts Urban Farming Conference. That's March 16th at Bunker Hill Community College. That's all Day, Friday, and Saturday. Really worth it. March 17th, there's a Plant a Row for the Hungry event being sponsored at the Port Washington Library. And if you want more information about that, come out to that. And I have a lot of things on my website. I don't want to take too much time, but check out all the events that I have listed there because they're really great. And I do want to let you all know that thanks to Audio Now, the Progressive Radio Network has an app. And all you have to do, if you would like to, go to the App Store on your cell phone, whatever cell phone you have, and search for the Progressive Radio Network. And you can find this app, which will allow you to listen live to our shows or listen into any of the archives. So just download it, and you'll be able to take PRN with you. So I now want to share with you this week's recipe and then invite my guest on. And so I made for you this week a coconut curry tempeh with vegetables and rice noodles. And I use these organic rice noodles that I get at Trader Joe's that are really great. They're spaghetti noodles, but they work well in so many of the different recipes that I make. So I use 2 cakes of organic tempeh. There's many different varieties of tempeh. I use the original, meaning it was made with soybeans. There's ones that are mixed grains. Some of the mixed grain ones are gluten-free and some are not. So if you need gluten-free, just check the ingredients there. But I use 2 cakes of the original tempeh, 2 tablespoons coconut oil, 2 tablespoons of finely chopped fresh ginger root, 1 tablespoon of finely chopped garlic cloves, 1 onion cut into slivers, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon curry powder, 1 teaspoon turmeric, 1/2 teaspoon cardamom, 1/2 teaspoon of ground coriander, 3 carrots cut into bite-sized pieces, 1 head of broccoli cut into florets, 1/2 large cauliflower. The cauliflower is just, you know, they're so big. Just if I used the whole one, it just would have been out of proportion with the amount of broccoli I had. So basically, you want about the same amount of broccoli and cauliflower. 1 can of chickpeas, 1 red pepper cut into bite-sized pieces, 4 teaspoons of Thai red curry paste. And you can buy that in the Asian aisle of your supermarket. It's a little glass jar, and it's just great. I have pictures on my website. If you don't know what it looks like, you can see a picture of the jar on my website. 2 cans of coconut milk, 1 tablespoon of honey, 1 cup of organic raw cashews, and then the pound of rice noodles. And I use cilantro to garnish. If you don't like cilantro, you can use parsley, but it just makes it look nice to sprinkle that on top. And for the cilantro, it adds a lot of flavor. So first I start by baking the tofu. I used to fry my tofu, but trying to cut down on oil, and it's, you know, it's always a pain to turn them over, whereas if you do it in the oven, it's much easier. So I covered a cookie sheet with parchment paper and sprayed it with some coconut oil. You can spray it with olive oil, anything you'd like, and spread the tempeh out so that they're not touching each other, so each one has space around it. And then I sprinkled all of the tempeh with a mixture of curry powder, cumin, garlic powder, turmeric, and ginger. Just sprinkle that over. You can toss it a little bit. I rolled it in the parchment paper to coat the whole tempeh with the spices and then spread it out again. And then baked it in the oven 15 to 20 minutes until it was golden brown. Halfway through, I took a look at it and flipped them over a little bit so that the bottoms became the tops, and so it was evenly golden brown. And when it was finished, I just removed it from the oven and set it aside. And then while that was in the oven, I used a wok to cook this up. I sauteed onions in some coconut oil, and I said it was about 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, till they were translucent. Then I added the carrots, the ginger, the garlic, and then the spices, or the curry powder, the cardamom, coriander, and salt. And I stirred that up. I lowered the heat a little bit and kept frying the onions for about 7 or 8 minutes until the onions and carrots were soft. If the spices start sticking, you can add a little bit of water, like 2 tablespoons at a time, to keep it from sticking instead of adding more oil. Then I added the cauliflower. That was the next thing that, you know, you add the vegetables in the according to how long they take to cook. So after the carrots and the onions, the cauliflower is next. Put that in for about 5 minutes. Then I added the broccoli, the red pepper, and the chickpeas, and sauteed that up till it started to get soft. And then I used a small mixer. You can also use just a small bowl, and I combined the coconut milk with the red Thai curry paste. and the honey, and I mix that all up well, and then I pour that into the wok and just let all those flavors come together. Then I added the cooked tempeh to the wok, and again, just let it simmer for like 10 minutes so that the flavor of the coconut curry milk goes into the tempeh and it all comes together. Then I cook the noodles separately. When you're cooking rice noodles, trick that I learned is if you just cook the rice noodles and pour them out, there's so much starch still on the noodles that they're all sticking together, and it really doesn't taste so good. So you really need to run it under cold water to stop the cooking and to wash off the starch. And then if you want to reheat it, you can just run it under hot water again, which is what I did, and then added it to the wok and stirred it all up so that the noodles became a part of the curry dish, and served it just like that. Sprinkled the cilantro on and the parsley on, and it was so good. So I do hope you all get to make it and enjoy it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Bren Smith. As I said before, he's the executive director of Green Wave, which is an ocean farmer and fisherman-run organization dedicated to supporting a new generation of ocean farmers and innovators who are working to restore ecosystems, mitigate climate change, and build a blue-green economy. He's also the owner of Thimble Island Ocean Farm, where he pioneered the development of the restorative 3D ocean farming that he's going to tell us about. Bren's a lifelong commercial fisherman and was named one of Rolling Stone's 25 People Shaping the Future. He was also featured in Time Magazine's Best Inventions of 2017. He's just an amazing guy. He was the winner of the 2015 Buckminster Fuller Challenge, and that's one of the most important prizes of sustainability. He's also been profiled on CNN, The New Yorker, and National Geographic, and his work is just amazing, so I'm so happy to have him on. Bren, are you with me?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on. Thanks so much.
Thank you. So as I mentioned to you when I first reached out to you, Brett Tully, who I've known for many years working with NAMA organization, he told me that I should look to you as someone doing it right. And so when I did, I was just so happy to see the work that you're doing. And so I wanted to start off our conversation asking you to just share a little bit of your history with my listeners so that they understand where you're coming from and then where you've kind of gotten to. So can you do that?
I sure can. I mean, Brett and NAMA, by the way, are just incredible grassroots organizations, just been sort of on the front line.
They are. You know, I met him years ago, and it was really just getting going. And now, you know, fast forward a few years, and they're really making a difference. And, you know, we have the Slow Food Fish campaign going now, and it's just great.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I was born and raised, my parents are from New York, but I was born and raised in Newfoundland, Canada, and, you know, dropped out of high school and at the age of 14 and headed out to sea. I fished Grand Banks, Georges Banks. I was in the Bering Sea fishing cod and crab. And so sort of come out of the industrialized fishing industry, which was, you know, I loved my job. Just the real sense of meaning and helping feed my country and the sort of the thrill and humility of being in 40-foot seas for 3 months at a time. But the trouble was we were, you know, what we know about industrialized fishing now, we were tearing up entire ecosystems, we're chasing fewer and fewer fish out to sea, and most of the fish I was catching was going to McDonald's at the time, the fish sandwich. So it was really the most unsustainable form of food production on the planet, you know, creating some of the most unhealthy food on the planet. But I was a kid, you know. And then the cod stocks crashed in Newfoundland. Back in my home, thousands of people.
So is cod the fish that McDonald's was buying for their fish fillets?
It used to be before the cod crashed. So this was back in the 80s. Now it's mostly, I believe, pollock is what they're using in their fish sandwich to make the fake crab, stuff like that. You know, as it's the classic, as one fishery is wiped out, the machines just sort of move to the next species.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when the cod disappeared, what it really taught me as a kid is that, you know, that my life and livelihood are tied to the ecology of the ocean and the earth. And in many ways, and I'd say this is climate change all the way over to overfishing, which is they're not really environmental issues. To someone like me, an everyday working person, they're economic issues. We say there are going to be no jobs on a dead planet. And for me to see my hometown and the ecological collapse, the economic collapse, that, you know, my town is hundreds of years of tradition, culture, local economy built up, just wiped out overnight. And I think that's been a real guiding light for me of how do we figure out ways that people like me can keep our meaningful, good jobs working on the ocean, but also revive ecosystems.
Right, but when you started fishing, you know, you're talking about the town being born on that, that being the tradition. They weren't dredging up the whole ocean floor, you know, many years ago. Isn't that more of a new industrial fishing model?
Yes, I mean, as a kid, there were all these. It was all the small day boats going out,
right,
digging
right.
Pod, totally sustainable. What was amazing was just offshore, the huge factory trawlers from around the globe. It was actually a lot of Spanish boats at that point. We're just sitting off, scooping up all the fish that were sort of circulating around the Grand Banks. So boats were happening at once. What's fascinating about the history of fishing, and Paul Greenberg has done great work on this, which is that our fleets became industrialized coming out of World War II. All the advances of major, like 400-foot vessels, seaplanes, technology, all of that after the war was laying latent, and it was repurposed into the fishing industry. And even, I was just reading the other day, that pilots, sea pilots, veterans were repurposed to fly with the industrial fleets to find schools of tuna. So that was really mm-hmm. the beginning of a massive sort of industrial shift, but also a cultural shift.
Right. Well, even the chemicals, I mean, became fertilizer, right? Agent Oranges and the, you know, all those warfare chemicals, they turned into the spray for our agricultural fields.
Yeah. Well, that's what's interesting is that when, you know, as the stocks, it was clear the stocks were being depleted, cod and other fish. You know, the big answer was aquaculture, which, you know, was to someone like me. And I went to the salmon farms in northern Canada as my next sort of stomping ground, as a search for sustainability, because I was told that aquaculture was the answer to overfishing, job creation, and really trying to feed the planet. But instead, as we know, it was using pesticides, fertilizers, you know, chalking fish full of antibiotics. I mean, it was essentially running Iowa pig farms at sea and really taking all those, that the harmful traditions of industrial agriculture and applying them in the ocean. And so I really became disillusioned very quickly with that and kept on searching for this, you know, what's a model of sustainably farming and food production at sea.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, with the hydroponics becoming popular, you know, and then people hear about aquaponics, and then you think aquaculture is the same as aquaponics, and is aquaponics good? And then is, you know, you hear farm-raised fish are bad, and then you hear, well, this is sustainably farm-raised fish. Can you clarify some of those terminologies for us? Because it's confusing. I mean, is it better to eat sustainably raised, farm-raised fish, or is it better to eat wild fish that is, you know, that's caught off the coast, you know, of or in the Gulf of Mexico when there's been an oil spill? I mean, you know, it's really hard to know what to eat.
Well, and this, I mean, this is why we have so, one of the reasons we have such low seafood consumption in the U.S. It's just confusing. These red, blue, but you know, red, green, blue labeling, the apps where, and the different species you're supposed to eat are shifting all the time based on, you know, rising and falling population stocks, climate change, all sorts of stuff. I mean, it is, and I, quite honestly, the what happens is people then shift to chicken and other land-based foods, which is a terrible choice because actually land-based, like chicken, is way more unsustainable in terms of water use, climate impact than even the worst form of aquaculture. So So like we don't want people to switch from seafood to land food. But from my view, the problem with the root, sort of the fundamental question for the oceans is, what do we grow, right? We have this amazing, pretty much blank plate out there. And I think we're too obsessed with fish. Eating fish is really a tradition coming out of a wild fishery, the tunas, the salmon, things like that. And since that's what people want to eat, we've tried to grow them. No, we need to ask the oceans, what does it make sense to grow? What are the benefits? What's sustainable? And that's not fish, right? Making things sustainable is no longer adequate. What sustainable means is taking a bad thing and making it better. And that's great, you know, clothing, different kinds of food. But no, with the threat of climate change, what we need to do is not seek sustainability, but seek restoration. How do we actually improve our oceans? How do we mitigate climate? Things like that. And that's what we shoot for. And in the oceans, it's an easy answer. Let's eat plants and shellfish. Because these are zero input foods. No fresh water, no feed, no fertilizers, of course, no land. And they just grow, you know, they're both easy to grow and the most sustainable food on the planet. And they soak up nitrogen, carbon, create artificial reefs, function as storm surge protectors. And that's where you get into this world of restoration and using Mother Nature's sort of agents of restoration to restore rather than deplete our seas. And I see that as a vision. So let's stop being obsessed with fish. Let's move fish to the edges of the plate, have it be a delicious treat that we have sometimes, just like, say a beef or a lamb, right? It becomes a sort of a cherished moment in the household. And let's move bivalves and sea greens to the center.
Well, you talk about, you know, oysters or sea vegetables cleaning up and mitigating climate change because they absorb the nitrogen, they absorb CO2. When they absorb that and then you eat it, is it contaminated? Is it, you know, are you eating, you know, all the toxins that you're trying to clean up? Or what happens?
So what, I mean, first of all, nitrogen, carbon are what we need to survive and our bodies need. Those aren't harmful. Now, our oceans are, in certain areas, there are heavy metals, things like that. There is harmful pollution. What we think of it is we split our farms in two sectors. We do food farming and we do pollution farming. So food we can do in sort of pristine waters that are regularly tested, very traceable. And then we can farm in urban areas like the Bronx, right under Hunts Point. There was a
right, and they're talking about doing that right by LaGuardia Airport in Long Island Sound to clean up the water.
Exactly. We're working with the San Diego ports to begin thinking through and using shellfish and seaweed to remediate waters. Now, you wouldn't eat that, but what's interesting is that can be used as biofuel. Turns out kelp is this incredibly powerful alternative fuel, but it's actually sustainable, unlike a lot of land-based biofuels, but honestly the corns and the soys, because of the nature of it being zero input. So we think about farming for food and we think about farming for pollution. And let me just back up and, you know, and like sort of describe the farm. Is that okay? Because it might be.
Let me tell people what it is. You're talking about your 3D ocean farm that you've invented. And, you know, that's why you've won these awards. And I mean, it's an amazing thing. So yes, please tell us about your 3D ocean farm.
Thanks. And, you know, it's funny. I don't see it as an invention. I see it as carrying on this tradition of an alternative form of farming our oceans that goes back thousands of years. The Romans did it with oysters and mussels. Native Americans farmed clams. There's just this whole alternative history that needs to be revived. Well, what I did was created what we call 3D ocean farming. Think of an underwater vertical garden. And we have these hurricane-proof anchors on the edges of the farm up to with ropes going vertically upwards. And then horizontal ropes down below the surface. And from there, we grow our seaweeds like kelp vertically downwards. We have mussels and mussel socks, scallops, and lanternets. And then our oysters are in cages down on the floor, sea floor. and clams down in the mud. And the idea is really how many restorative species can we grow in small areas that are, you know, delicious, healthy, but also create jobs. Now, the benefit of 3D ocean farming is, one, very small footprint. My farm used to, I used to have a farm on about 50, 60 acres. I'm down to 10 acres and grow way more food than before because it's vertical. Anybody can swim and fish and boat over our farms. Because they're underwater, we're not privatizing these spaces. We're making community spaces and welcoming people in to dive and kayak and fish on our farms. And finally, they have low aesthetic impact, right? Our oceans are beautiful, pristine places. We really need to keep them that way. You come out to, I always say I run the worst eco tour in the country. People come out and see the farm, and there's kind of nothing to see. It's just some buoys because everything's submerged underwater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my later questions was to see whether or not you could tour it, but I guess you can't really see it.
But that's a good thing, right? We can lift our gear up and show people our crops, but it's all underwater. You know, it's also scalable. I think this is important for sort of the progressive community, where we all agree climate change is real. It will radically reshape our economy and our society. It's going to impact whether, you know, wildfire, storms, floods, droughts. But we're sort of obsessed with hyper small scale solutions. And the question is, how do we create solutions that are small scale but replicable to scale? Because we have to really be put forth solutions that can address climate change. So our little piece of the puzzle, World Bank did a study, and if you were to take less than 5% of U.S. territorial water and create type of ocean farms, you'd create 50 million jobs and sequester the amount of carbon equivalent that gets put out by 20 million cars, right? We can. You want to rebuild the middle class? You want to do what the supposed Trump agenda really is? Let's farm the ocean and actually restore the seas. I mean, this is what's exciting about climate change. There's so much work to be done addressing the crisis. This could be the biggest job creator since World War II, and that's what's, for us, that's an exciting space.
It's really exciting, not only creating jobs, but it's also providing more food because, you know, we always hear people talking about how are we going to feed the 9 billion people that are going to be on the planet. And, you know, that's why we need GMOs, which, of course, you know, those of us in the know that that's not true. But, you know, it's the myth that's being promoted and that there's not going to be enough food. And so we do know that there's, you know, depleting fish in the ocean, and this is a wonderful as you said, scalable way and giving people jobs at the same time. But that leads to my next question. Isn't it really expensive to get started with this? How can, you know, we keep hearing about, you know, farmers, you know, the majority of our farmers are over the age of 60, and young farmers that want to get into farming, you know, can't afford land and it's so expensive. How can somebody get set up in this? Is it really expensive in the same way that land farming is?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. The good thing is I'm a really cheap person. While I was doing this, I lived in an old Airstream trailer for 10 years and sold sort of hawk stuff to tourists for a decade on the streets of New York City while I was trying to figure out how to do this. And I became obsessed with, how do you make the nail salon model of a seat? How do you make something with minimal capital cost, minimal skill requirements to make it accessible to everyday people? You don't have to be an Amazon, a Google, a Walmart, or Elon Musk to get involved in the sort of new climate solutions movement. But a regular person. So we designed it so anybody with 20 acres and a boat and $20,000 can start their own farm, be up and growing.
And when you say 20 acres, are you talking about 20 acres of land?
No, 20 acres of water lease. And you can, you know, our farmers, some start with 2 acres, some 5, some 10, some 20. Now, what's fascinating in this sort of 20 acres and a boat, $20,000 model is that young. So we have requests to start farms in every coastal state in North America and 20 countries in the world because it's cheap and easy to do. And so we've got 11th generation fishermen. We've got lobstermen, but we also have droves of young land-based farmers who are coming to us because it's $25 an acre to lease property on, you know, water rights. It's, so you don't need buildings. You don't need land. And that's what's beautiful about the ocean. Suddenly you can grow things that you don't need to feed, which is expensive, that you don't need land for. You don't need water or you don't need buildings. Because underwater, we really don't have to fight gravity. It's just simply rope scaffolding systems and then figuring out what to grow on those scaffolding. So that's
been And then it does its own thing. You just kind of like set it up and then it magic happens?
Yeah, I mean, our job is to make sure, for example, our kelp has the right mix of sunlight and nutrients. So really the sort of art of ocean farming is to figure out what species to put at different levels of the water column, and then just maintain the gear with you know, putting buoys on, taking them off, checking your ropes, things like that, to make sure everything stays stable and at the right height. It's not extremely complicated, just because what we're doing is, instead of creating pens and trapping fish which want to swim away and feed them, we're growing things that just sort of naturally stick around, and we don't have to feed. So it just changes the economics and the skill requirements of dynamics.
Uh-huh. Wow. I have so many questions, but before I get into them, let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I really want to know how one goes about leasing water. I didn't even know that was something that you could do. And talk about how Green Wave is changing all that. So everyone, don't go anywhere. You're talking to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and Bren Smith is my guest. Be right back.
You're listening to PRN, number one for progressive minds.
Get your daily dose of happy each morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on PRN. LOA Today is expanding to appear on PRN now 5 mornings per week, Monday through Friday. I'm Walt Thiessen, the host of LOA Today. The way you start your day sets the tone for the rest of the day, so start it happy. We explore the realm of positive psychology, the law of attraction, and the power of positive thinking, and we have a heck of a lot of fun in the process. You'll find yourself smiling each morning. That's LOA Today, weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Eastern Time here on PRN.
This is Jim Fetzer, the conspiracy guy, a new program appearing on PRN.FM. I'm delighted to be joining a wonderful collection of hosts to delve into the politically loaded events that the government has been motivated to misrepresent to the American people. The biggies being JFK, 9/11, the death of the plane crash that took the life of Paul Wellstone, but also Sandy Hook, Boston bombing. Stand by for more. The show will be Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
PRN.FM, your station for progressive viewpoints on politics, economics, health, the environment, and a whole lot more. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Bren Smith. He's the executive director of Green Wave and founder of Thimble Island Oyster Company. And we're just talking about the new wave of ocean farming that Bren has invented or actually brought back. And it's really exciting. So, Bren, are you with me again?
I sure am.
Great. So right before we left, I wanted to ask, how do people get access to Coastal Waters? I know you said you lease it for $25 per acre, but who owns it? Who do you lease it from?
Yeah, so we, there are three ways. One is in some states, it's the town that you lease from. Others, or it can be the state waters, or it can be federal waters. We work hyper locally with towns and states, and we don't own the water. What we own is the right to grow shellfish and seaweed on in these areas. So anybody can do anything else. They can lobster, gill net, they can kayak, whatever they want. The only people are blocked from doing is the right to grow shellfish and seaweed. So in many ways, we own a process right, not a property right. I think that's really important because we don't want to privatize the seas. The other thing is our leases are up for review every 5 years or so. So there's a lever of community control so that if we're doing terrible things, we can those leases can be revoked. I think this is really important because there's such a push, whether it's offshore drilling or mining the ocean or the worst forms of industrial aquaculture, to really replay the privatization and the corporatization that's happened in our land.
Uh-huh. So what shellfish do you grow right now?
So I grow scallops, mussels, oysters, and clams.
Scallops, mussels, oysters, and clams. And do you personally grow both for food and for pollution, or do you focus mostly on food?
I'm mainly on food. I've got two sites, one in Groton up near Mystic, Connecticut, and one in the Thimble Islands down in Branford outside of New Haven. But what's fascinating about the sea vegetable piece is that it's food, but we can use it for all sorts of things. Like it makes an incredible organic fertilizer. So all of our waste, everything that's not used for food, goes into these organic health seeds for fertilizers. And that's really important. Like too often our thinking about the food system stops at the water's edge. This sort of new generation of ocean farming, we're able to build a bridge between land and sea. We've got a great program with the Yale Sustainable Food Project to use our crops as fertilizer and develop new to do that, because we can. This is what the circular economy looks like. We can share nutrients, land and sea. We can share infrastructure. We can create kelp and mushroom jerkies like beyond the shoreline in New York. And we can break down the idea of what a farmer is, so someone can farm mushrooms and kale on land and kelp in the ocean in winter and off season. And you actually sort of completely open up the profession. It's kind of bizarre. I go to all these food things, and there's a seafood breakout group and a land-based farming breakout group. But no, these should be fully integrated.
Uh-huh. So what other sea vegetables besides kelp can you grow? Because, I know, there's so many that come out of Japan, and, in our society, we don't really know how to cook many of them. I do cook with some seaweeds, nori and arame and wakame and kombu and hiziki. Those are basically the ones that I work with.
Well,
but I'm sure there's many, many others that I have no idea about. I get some in the Japanese restaurant that I have no idea what they are. So,
First of all, what's fascinating is that there are thousands of kinds of ocean plants, edible ocean plants, and hundreds of kinds of shellfish that we can eat. But we only... And that we can eat and grow, right? But there are only a couple that we do that, right? So this is, I grow kelp and gracilaria in the past, but I concentrate mainly on the sugar kelp right now. This is just the beginning, right? Kelp becomes the gateway drug for an entirely new cuisine. And that's, I think, what's exciting to chefs. We bring our kelp noodles, for example, to Brooks Headley in New York City at the Superiority Burger, and he whips up barbecue kelp noodles with parsnips and breadcrumbs. And you can see breaking out and desushifying sort of seaweeds and these native things that we can grow becomes an exciting space. I think of it sort of as climate cuisine. A side note is that we think of seaweed specifically really as Asian, but which it is. They have incredible, brilliant tradition. I've been to South Korea, other areas, sort of learning from the farmers there. What's fascinating is that there's an entire sort of lost culinary history of seaweeds in the West and a lost history of farming seaweed. So nori, for example, is a woman in a scientist in Britain that was able to sort of break, I don't know much about the science, but was able to break through a set of problems around nori seeding and sporing, which was then brought to Japan, which created the basis of their nori farming industry. There's actually a statue to her in this one town in Japan and a yearly festival to this, this British woman. Then, you know, there was the kelp highway where along South America was standard in Peruvian cuisine. Italians use seaweeds all the time in their spaghetti sauces, Irish and breads, and even, you know, as a kid, me in Newfoundland, the best vegetables you could get were seaweed, because all the land-based vegetables had to be shipped in because, you know, Newfoundland's a rock. So part of what we're doing is trying to revive both the farming and revive this Western culinary cuisine, and luckily it comes just in time as our land-based food systems being pushed out to sea. So I think, you know, climate change is always a depressing story, but for us, it's kind of an exciting space where we can grow delicious, healthy, beautiful food that captures carbon and create jobs. Like, this is the, you know, this is what I love about 350 and other organizations. I took a group of fishermen and ocean farmers by boat to the climate march in New York and a climate march in D.C. to join the huge climate coalition of solutions, right? Folks solarizing the haulers in Kentucky, folks doing solar in on tribal lands around the country, urban gardens in Detroit. Like, we're this whole movement, I think, of what I call the politics of yes, of solutions, of building a new, better world. And too often, environmentalists are sort of caught in the politics of no, which is let's stop pipelines, stop coal plants, which we really need to do. But the question for our movement is, what's the yes? What are we going to build? What are our solutions? We know out of whether Democratic or Republican elite spheres, they have no answers at all. But we do. I think our movement can be the force for vision, force for good.
I love that. What's the yes? It's, you know, it's those people thinking outside of the box as to how we can transform this situation and create opportunities for growth and for renewable, you know, sustainable innovations that really have the potential to make such a huge difference. I love what you're doing. It's just, you know, it's so exciting. It's really great.
We're just what I've learned from the climate movement is that, you know, we're a piece of the puzzle. We're just doing our own small bit of it at Greenway. But there really is this sort of, you know, all around the country, and I expect the world, blue collar innovation that's going on. We're just sort of proud to be part of it. And I think we created GreenWave, our nonprofit, to really be part of replicating, scaling, and joining others in this movement of solutions.
Mm-hmm. And you were saying the kelp can also be used for biofuel?
Yeah, I mean, kelp is sort of, you can think of it as the soy of the sea, but not evil, which is that we can, yes, we can use it for food. We can make kelp the new kale, move it to the center of the plate, but we can also weave it through a whole bunch of existing industries and make them better. We can use it as fertilizer, animal feed. You give cows a majority diet of seaweed, and you get up to a 90% reduction in methane output because it changes their stomach. So fertilizer, feed, pharmaceuticals, even cosmetics, people use it for. I don't get into that sphere, but biofuels. So there's this sort of pyramid of value for these new sea vegetables that I think creates huge opportunity. I mean, You know, not everybody's going to be eating sea vegetables, although I'd argue it's coming because as the price of land-based food goes up because of water costs, land costs, fertilizer feed costs, in the era of climate change, our zero-input food is the most affordable food on the planet. The climate economy is going to be driving up land-based farming costs and making us increasingly affordable so it's food for regular folks. We just have to make it delicious and beautiful, but that's what our chefs are doing.
Mm-hmm. So you've separated Thimble Island Oyster Company is your farm where you're growing, and then Green Wave is the nonprofit that you started to help train others in this farming method. Is that correct?
Exactly. You know, we really believe that I've got my farm, but we believe in hybrid models. So we have a nonprofit which does training and education. It does policy work. Like New York, for example, it's not legal to grow seaweeds right now. So we've got a campaign we're going to start called Legalize the Other Weeds. That's the role of Green Wave. We do R&D to improve hatchery efficiency, things like that. Our training program, farmers get permitting support, 2 years of sort of hands-on training. They get free seed during the training program. They get winter gear from Patagonia. Patagonia is a big sponsor of ours. And we arrange, we facilitate so that up to 80% of what farmers produce has a guaranteed sale at triple the market rate. And that's so important. Like, we could train all these farmers. They grow all this stuff, but it just goes into the commodity market. We use Green Wave to partner with processing plants, value-added producers. For example, Sea Green Farms is one, and do these forward contracts for all our trainers so they can start growing, but they know where this stuff is going to go. So that hybrid relationship between the nonprofit and the for-profit sector, I think, is an important piece of the new economy.
Yeah, just like so many specialty farmers who are, you know, growing organic, you know, make contracts directly with restaurants and chefs or community supported agriculture so that they can sell directly to them at the market price and not, you know, cut out the wholesale so that they can make a living.
Right, you know, right in New York there, Dr. Dish, Sean Barrett just really led the way, and it's a very close partner with us in making sure there's sort of great high-priced options for farmers to sell their goods. And that's why, you know, we train and build the farms, and then we work with wide networks of scientists, purchasers, processors, students to really move this new industry forward.
Fascinating. So if any of the listeners are interested in becoming a sea farmer, do they just look up Green Wave online? What's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Sure, you go to greenwave.org, and we've got a farmer training sort of sign up if people are interested in putting an application. People can also sponsor a farmer through our training program. But, you know, because we have thousands of requests to start farms, we can't at this point help everybody. It's heartbreaking. But what we're working on right now is an open source training manual so that and provide that to people for free so they can get up and starting their own farms. We also have a program to train the trainer. So every state with its somebody that we've trained that then agrees to train other people, and that's how we scale. But people should come to greenway.org, you know, join us, and it's an exciting space, but we need all hands on deck.
That's so exciting. Now, I just want to have a quick question. You said that that it's illegal in New York. What's illegal, to lease the land, to lease the water in New York?
Well, it's not legal, so it's not like it's been banned, but you can't go and just start growing kelp, say, on your oyster ground. So, no, you can get leases. That's very possible and isn't too hard. But you're not allowed to plant something like kelp. So, and that just shows how early all this. We're working with New York State, a whole coalition of folks, to create legislation that will move this forward and make sure it's, you know, good and like, you know, limit the amount of grounds that people can lease, things like that. So this is a good industry. But no, we did it here in Connecticut. We had to pass a bill called the Seaweed Jobs Bill. We're working on one in California now. We sit on the Mariculture Commission and Green Wave. But New York's our next thing. Actually, with Dr. Dish, with Sean Barrett, he's leading our New York program in order to start training new people, to move the move legislation forward, work with buyers. So he's really our, we think of as a Green Wave Reef manager. So
perfect. If you, well, if you would send me, Brent, if you send me that information, I'll make sure to include it in my actions in my newsletter, because I'm passionate about this. I think this is really great, and I would like to help move that legislation forward in whatever way I can. So,
okay, sounds good.
Great. Send that to me. And we're just about out of time, so I want to thank you, Bren, so much for joining me and for the work you're doing. Amazing. Really exciting and amazing.
It's an absolute honor to be on, and you keep up the good work telling everybody's story.
Thank you. And everyone who's joined us today, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you again next week. Have a great rest of the week, and bye for now.